So this is the first day of our four-day retreat here in Tampa in October 2012. And in this retreat, we are dealing with the life and the teachings of Milarepa. And we call this retreat Awakening is Possible for Everyone. Transformation is Possible for Everyone. But let me just begin by saying a few other things. First of all, in the Buddhist tradition, the Dharma is compared to pure, fresh milk. Students are compared to pots. And there are various kinds of pots. Some pots are upside down. So when the milk is poured from the pitcher, it just all goes in the ground. Nothing goes in the pot. Other students are compared to dirty pots. The milk, fresh and pure, is poured into the pot, but because the pot is so dirty, everything, the milk gets defiled. That refers, the first obviously refers to students who have, or someone who has no openness at all. And so it just, nothing gets in. That's the upside-down pot. This pot that is dirty refers to somebody who is so filled of their own conceptions and ideas and opinions that when the Dharma is poured into them, they twist everything. They contaminate everything through their own viewpoints. And their own viewpoints, of course, of what got them in the trouble in the first place. But yet they still cling to it and interpret the Dharma and through their views. Then there is a third type of student who has an upright pot, has a clean pot, but this pot has lots of holes in it. So even though the pure water, the pure milk of Dharma is poured in, and even though the pot is clean, because of all these holes, it all seeps out. Nothing stays. So this is talks about a third student who is open, who is willing to listen and learn, because they do not go over it. They do not reflect on the Dharma. And they do not really practice it, it all just seeps out. So no matter how much Dharma is poured in, year after year after year, the bowl, the pot is never full. So nurturance never occurs. Obviously, I'm hoping that everyone here is like the fourth pot. It's just a good, clean pot, no holes, no dirt, and able to hold the precious Dharma. As it said in the verse this morning, this Dharma that is deep and lovely can hold it. So we as human beings can become deep and lovely human beings. So we will be dealing with Milarepa. But let me just say also, before we begin, context. And in Milarepa, both in his teachings, but also very much in his life and the stories of his life, someone who is following a spiritual path is somebody who is willing and able to see the bigger picture of what's going on in life. The ordinary person, the worldly person, people not too much unlike ourselves, don't see the bigger picture. All they see is what's in front of them. All they see is the way they've been conditioned. So they endlessly go around in the activities of life, endlessly trying to find a happiness, meaning, purpose, peace, security, safety, love, hope. You know, they're always seeking for these things, but never find it in any intrinsically meaningful or consistent way, and yet never in a million years figure out what's wrong. They think what's wrong is either they got a, you know, they got dealt or a bad deck in life, or else they, you know, or else they just think, I just got to do it differently. But always within the context of worldly life, do it harder, do it different, do something else. But they never see outside the box. They never look over the prison walls. They never see the vast space or the vast sky and how to get there. So when we come to a spiritual path, it is because we are willing to look deeply into life and to ask good questions. It's good to have good questions. Why is there suffering in life? Why is there dissatisfaction in life? Why, with so many material resources, is there so much impoverishment? Why, with so much capacity for altruism in life, is there such pettiness, such insensitivity, such injustice? Violence, war, why? And why, again, when I look at myself, when I look at those around me, why cannot real happiness be experienced? True joy, true meaning. And so when one begins to ask these types of questions, one begins to look more deeply at life, and one begins to see that there are certain patterns common to all human beings, certain shared perceptions, views, that are never talked about, that perhaps may be at the root of all the problems. A Buddha, a Christ, a spiritual teacher, a master, is someone who looks deeply into these questions and finds a solution, finds an answer. And the answer is outside the box. Way outside the box. That is why we find that the Dharma is so precious, and that such respect and love is paid to those teachers and masters who have found another way and have taught another way, and through their own life and example have showed us how to live another way. So again, we are here on retreat for 4 days, and we are here dealing with the life and the teachings of Milarepa. I mean, this is in the, you know. But I hope all of you are listening in the context of your own seeking, your own questioning, and your own desire to really bring a deep and profound transformation, an awakening, an enlightenment into your life. So that you will not only, you yourself, experience really what it means to be a human being, in the best sense of the word, but you will really have the capacity to be a benefit, to be a light to other beings, our brothers and sisters, our family, who do not know better. They are not to be faulted. They are not to be looked down upon because they do know better. They're doing their best. If there's anybody that we need to critique, it is only ourself. We who have been exposed to this precious Dharma, we who have been given the technology of transformation, it is only our half-hearted efforts that continue to keep us caught in our reactivity, in our conditioning, in our ageless patterns of dissatisfaction. For that, we have nobody to blame but ourselves. But having said that, that is not something to dwell on. That is just saying, if we want to fault anyone, we should only fault ourselves, and then we should get on with it. Take up the great work of liberating all beings. And Milarepa is one of those people. So I want to spend today talking a bit about his life. He's an interesting guy. And now we're talking, this is the 11th century. He's an interesting guy. Most of us, like our teachers, sort of like the Dalai Lama and the Thich Nhat Hanh, right? They're clean, they bathe regularly, they shave, they're nice. They say nice things, they're rational, they go out of their way to explain things to us, you know what I mean? They're presentable. Right? They meet with leaders and they go around the world, you know, hobnobbing with all sorts of celebrities, and we like that. You know, we read about them in the paper, and on Google, we see they're up to this and that, meeting with this one and that one, and, you know. So we like that kind of teacher, don't we? Somebody who's like us. Just a little further along, but we can clearly identify with them. Milarepa is a different sort of guy, as we will see. And he comes from a lineage of different sort of guys in the Buddhist tradition. Which makes him so wonderful. And it makes it so interesting that there was such a culture of Dharma in Tibet, where even though the kind of path that he followed and the kind of life that he lived was rare, I mean, he certainly did have many followers, and his tradition lives till today, even though most people did not follow it, it was deeply respected. People knew the genuine thing. And his great exertions for awakening, his awakening, his teachings, his songs, and mostly his dedication, his willingness to overcome all obstacles in the pursuit of his own truth, the uncompromising integrity of his life, deeply resonated with people. Irrespective of whether they were going to adopt his lifestyle. And that's wonderful. Unfortunately, I don't know if those kind of society exists anymore in our own world, where we can really tolerate someone who lives outside the conventionalities of life. It doesn't, shows the Dharma, shows the truth of things in this bold, eccentric, uncompromising way, as this mad yogi, Milarepa. But so let me say something. Let me talk about him because again, he's greatly known for his teachings, his songs, his profundity, but he's also very known for his story. His story is really very much a teaching, and that's what I would sort of want to begin with you. And let me just say with Milarepa, oh, let there be light. And there was light, or there is light. Thank you. He is not, please understand, he is not a mythological person. He's an historical person, and even though probably over time, a little exaggeration probably occurs over time, his life is well documented. You can go to Tibet and all the major places, caves, places where he practiced and stayed, and his disciples, and where the village he came from, and all that have all been preserved. I mean, even though with the Chinese and everything, they came into ruins, have all been pilgrimage places for 1,000 years and preserved within the Tibetan tradition. You may wonder about some things, and because he was asked in these texts that I'm referring, he was asked by his disciples while he was still alive to talk about his life. And so his life is well documented. So as I said earlier, he lived in the 11th century. He was born to a family that were considered well off for his village, which sort of meant they had their yaks, they had their cows, they had their land, they were able to trade. They had leftover, a little surplus wealth. So they were widely thought of as a well-off people in their village. And also they had come from a family on his paternal side of sort of shamans. And we know at this time in Tibet, even though Buddhism had been there for hundreds of years, the pre-Buddhist tradition in Tibet was very much a shamanic tradition. Lots of magic and spells and a lot of shamans who went around doing healings and exorcism, and the world was very much alive with demons, etc., etc. And the shamans had the esoteric knowledge to control them. And they came from a lineage of that, and that was a good living in those days. To be a shaman. So he grew up in a family of wealth, comparative wealth. But when he was young, I forget, 6 or 8 or something, his father died. And at the death of his father, his father willed that his brother and sister-in-law, sort of his relatives, kind of caretake his wealth, caretake his family until his son, and Mila was his son, came into his majority, which I believe was either, I think it's 16, 15 or 16. But what happened was his aunt and uncle being their minds enshrouded with greed and self-interest, took it all for themselves and actually turned their sister-in-law, Milarepa's mother, and Milarepa and he had one sister, basically into servants. So you can see they had a complete turnabout from being widely kind of respected and sort of in the upper class of their small community in Tibet. They became servants. They became looked down upon. They had nothing. But the mother always, even though she had great resentment, she always felt, because in the will that the father had left, he said at 15, all his wealth and everything would be invested in his son. She always looked forward to that date. And when that date finally came and Milarepa turned 15 or 16, she borrowed a lot of money. She borrowed some money and sold, I don't know, some things. And she had a big party to celebrate Mila's 15th birthday, at which point she announced to the assemblage, including the aunt and uncle, and now it is time to return to my son Mila, the wealth that you have been the custodians of, even though we were holding on to it quite dearly. At which point they were very dismissive of her, said, "What are you talking about? You have nothing. You've never had anything. All the stuff that we took from your husband was stuff that was originally ours." Basically said, "Screw you." At this, of course, since the mother was very resentful all these years, but had thought, she would have at least to have her release at this time, was devastated. Not only was she devastated, she was angry. And basically, it was, the challenge of the aunt and uncle when she challenged him was, either come make war on us, destroy us, or just go your way. So she took up the challenge. And I think probably because of their tradition, she deeply impressed upon her son the necessity that he go forth and find a black magician and basically learn the black arts to wreak revenge on the aunt and uncle for what they've done. So at that point, Milarepa went off, and his mother again sold some more things so he would have offerings, and he went to some well-known magician type to study with him, and he studied with him for several years. He seemed to have a natural affinity. He was a good student, he had a good capacity to concentrate, and he was a good master of the dark arts, culminating in being taught the capacity to affect change over physical substances. And when he had mastered that art, he returned to his village, or outside his village, and erected this whole kind of little building or anything. At that point, there was a wedding going on in the village. The wedding of the, I think it was either the daughter of the son of the aunt and uncle, and there was a great wedding going on. It was during this wedding feast that Milarepa cast his spells and caused the collapse of the building. So in that building were not only the children of the aunt and uncle weren't in the building. They were, at the time it happened, they were doing something, but there was a great party going on, and I think 30 or 40 people were killed. The mother was delighted. The mother was happy that her son had wreaked. She had no empathy at all. She was happy that the evil that had been done to her had now been requited. But it turned out that the uncle and the aunt were not going to take this laying down, and they said, we're going to go kill her and kill her son for what they've done when they found out that it was Milarepa who did it. Milarepa had returned to his teacher. She went into hiding and sent word to her son what was going to happen, and so he went and talked to his teacher what he should do next, and he said, there's another magician, they don't call them magicians, but anyhow, who has a great capacity for hailstones, to create hail, you go study with him. And so Milarepa went and studied with him. He mastered those special invocations and whatever, returned to the village, and created massive hailstorms that basically wiped out all the the fields of the community. At this point, the village was put on notice that if you mess with us, you'll all be killed. And at that point, I guess some of her lands were returned. So the important thing up to now is to to see it in a perhaps a more modern context. We see that in Milarepa's adolescent life, he did bad things. You know, there may be people sitting here who say, oh, I have a, when I look at my past, I have a heavy karma. Oh, I did this, and I did that, and I did this, you know. I mean, has anybody here killed 37 people? He killed, he murdered, deliberately, 37 people. He destroyed the livelihood of many more. So please understand, he was bad. He was a bad man. He had a, he was more than an acting out teenager. So please understand the context in which what's going on here. And he had the support of, I mean, many acting out teenagers who'd go out and do bad things don't have the support of their family. He had the complete and utter support of his mother and encouragement. So every now and then when you read about families, you know, when they're all in it together, it was that kind of family. And again, she had actually been a good woman earlier on, but she was just filled with resentment. She could not see anything but revenge. And so these types of mind states, resentments, wanting revenge, wanting harm to come to people who you feel have harmed you, perhaps these kinds of emotions or feelings are not unknown even to the noble assemblage in this room. Even to a much lesser degree, we've known those feelings. So let me continue on now, kind of skipping around a little bit. Let's see what happens. I'm not sure how much to share, but again, I think it's fun to listen to stories, isn't it? And these are wonderful stories because they're great teachings. And in this, The Life of the Milarepa, which is a translation from the Tibetan, there are various lives of Milarepa and there are various collections of his teachings or songs. So this is from one of the lives. And it is presented as a dialogue between Rechung. Rechung was one of his major students. And actually, interesting enough, when my son and I were in Tibet 10 or 12 years ago, we went to Rechungpa, which was Rechung's monastery. And I was just when I thought of this word, I had forgotten that. And that even though it had been primarily destroyed by the Chinese, they destroyed pretty much most of the monasteries, it was being slowly rebuilt. And I remember two significant things there. One was in a little room that you went into, there was a staff, a wooden staff, which they said this was a staff of Milarepa's. And so everybody would come in and venerate this staff, this wooden staff of Milarepa. But also, as is traditional for a lot of original monasteries in Tibet or other places, they began as places where the original teacher or master, the founder, practiced. So it was a cave. So kind of underneath the monastery was a wonderful cave where Rechung had meditated for many years. And then, you know, usually what happened was disciples would come and people gather around and you'd see them. They'd live in various caves and they'd build little places and dwellings and sort of a whole kind of community, kind of rough. But over time, patrons would come and they'd kind of get a little money and start building something more substantial, and that's how monasteries, temples began. So Rechungpa, after Milarepa had told this earlier stories, he said he wanted to then ask, which is an obvious question, because at this point, Milarepa is a venerable Dharma teacher, master, Buddha. He said, when did you encounter the Dharma? when did you make this, when did this shift? And then he, and Milarepa says, I was filled with remorse for the evil I had done by magic and by hailstones. I mean, I think in terms of a spiritual development, all of us need these key moments where we turn away from our historical life and seek something different. We know with Shakyamuni, Siddhartha, it was his encounter with, when he went outside the palace walls with his charioteer and encountered a sick person, an old person, a dead person, and a hermit. It was his experience with impermanence and seeing it in the flesh that got him wanting to question and turn. Obviously, Milarepa, after that all was over, and he kind of had time to reflect, you know what I mean? He kind of got away from his mother, outside of her influence. And was able to reflect on his own. You could see he did have his own. Up to then, he didn't have his own conscience. He didn't have his own capacity to self-reflect. He was, he was just doing what his mother told him to do, and he obviously wanted her approval. And hopefully, he was probably resentful too of what had been done. But obviously, after this whole thing, and he thought about these years he had spent learning the black arts and how it had just led. To murder and killing and harming so many people, and all the destruction he had done. He said, I was filled with remorse. Right? He felt bad for what he had done. And then he said, my longing for the teaching so obsessed me that I forgot to eat. If I went out, I wanted to stay in. If I stayed in, I wanted to go out. At night, sleep escaped me. I dared not confess my sadness to the Lama. This is the Lama. Lama means teacher. So this is the teacher, his black arts teacher. My longing for liberation. While I remained in his service, I asked myself unceasingly and passionately by what means I might practice the true teaching. So again, we see... not only is there a remorse for the way he lived, but there is a desire for something different. And we can see Milarepa is an unusual guy. I mean, he doesn't do anything half-heartedly. I mean, as soon as he made that shift, he can't sleep. He's just in a state. He's so full of remorse. He so wants to get out of this. To be free of whatever life he's created for himself, that he is he's just beside himself. Things unfold, and his teacher listens to him and says, "Well, there's a great teacher of the great perfection down the road, which is a great teaching within the at that time the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Why don't you go to him?" And he goes to him, and the teacher says, "Yes, I can liberate you, these are the practices to do." And so he gave Milarepa the practices. Milarepa went in retreat, and got no benefit at all. Got no results at all. At that time, the teacher said, "Ooh, this guy is a hard nut. These practices work for people. This guy must have a heavy-duty karma. He needs a heavy-duty teacher." So he mentioned the name of Marpa. And if you look, if you see Milarepa, and it's, I know, hard to see now, there he is in the posture of royal ease, sitting there. Above him is Marpa. Marpa, his teacher. So I don't want to go too much into Marpa, But Marpa is an interesting guy in and of himself. And this is the life of Marpa. You notice him? Can you see this? He's got a full head of hair, a mustache. Doesn't look like the Dalai Lama, does he? Doesn't look like Thich Nhat Hanh. This is Marpa. I'll just read a couple of things. One is from the life of Marpa. It talks a little about his childhood. He was one of three children. From the time he was very young, Marpa was very short-tempered and stubborn. His father said, this is Marpa's father, if my son doesn't go the wrong way, he'll be very successful, whether he follows a dharma or worldly life, and there'll be great benefit for himself and others. If he goes the wrong way, he will bring disaster on himself and everyone else. Considering the potential benefits and risks, it would be good to entrust him to the dharma from the beginning. So it's good to understand that not everyone who is sent to the monastery is sent because they have high spiritual aspirations. You can see traditionally it was sort of sent like a reform school. And people, you know, so sometimes if you hang around monasteries enough, you will encounter people, you go, what are they doing here? This is not my... And so you get a lot of rough characters in there that somebody realized, you know, this person let loose in society is only going to cause harm. Let's at least put him in the monastery. He can't do much harm there. So they thought, I mean, since they didn't have, military schools or, you know, reform schools in those days, they sent him to the monastery. So at 12 years old, he was sent to a local temple, study reading, writing, but he had a great sharpness in mind. He mastered the teachings very quickly, but he was aggressive. He liked to fight very much. So again, his family said, Marpa could cause great harm, killing himself or us. He's so out of control. They were scared of him. Or he could do other things, less harm, such as damaging our wealth, our fields, our home. Everyone in the home and outside were saying bad and slanderous things about Marpa. So his father said it'd be best if he went to study with another guru far away from home. And so he was sent off to study with a Dharma teacher as opposed to the local. Marpa was a very interesting man. I won't go much into his life at all. Evidence say that not only was he a practitioner, but he was a translator. He made three journeys to India. At this time, Buddhism was still very prevalent in India. The great Buddhist universities were still in existence, and the Buddhist traditions, in many, many ways, were still very alive. So Marpa was part of a whole slew of various kinds of Tibetans who would make the journey across the Himalayas, you know, very difficult journeys, as you could imagine, go to India to encounter teachers, but also to gather teachings, text, and to bring them back to Tibet. So this is part of the transfer of Buddhism from India to Tibet. So Marpa made three journeys to India, but his karma brought him encounter not with members of the more traditional monastic tradition, but with the kind of hermit, crazy yogi, outside the law, people with names like Talopa and Naropa, and other kinds of names. I mean, Wildman. Interestingly enough, many of them had started out in the great universities of Ikshamila, of Nalanda, and had reputable reputations and advancement within the monastic, but had left, feeling the constraints of that kind of practice and teaching, and were living highly eccentric lives, highly unconventional lives, outside the traditional Buddhist fields. And this was the kind of people that Marpa were encountering. And I'll just give you one example, and that'll really be it, because we really want to focus on Milarepa. But I want to give you a sense of Marpa and where he was at, because it's interesting that that was the teacher that Milarepa went to practice with. It talks about on his first journey to India, he was staying at the home of a prince. And actually, the prince's father had known Marpa in the past and had been a great supporter for him. And Marpa stayed there a month and taught Dharma to them. And one day, the prince said to Marpa, who he looked at as his teacher, he said, Guru, my father, I received you warmly before. Now I'm alone doing so, and today I request at this feast, they were having this feast, to please sing a song not sung before, a song unifying words and meaning. And so Marpa is now going to sing a song describing this dream and experience. He then sang in the melody of the outstretched wings of a soaring Garuda, this mythical bird, this grand song, a Vajra song that pierces to the pith of the mind. And this is his song. And again, as I think I said yesterday, these are spontaneous songs. This is not a songwriter crafting a song. These are spontaneous songs. And that to this day, there are those who do that. And so he sang. Let me just say, having heard these types of song, there is a certain format. So it's not like free-form music. There's a certain kind of format of rhythm and tone that these songs often follow. I mean, and they vary. So there is a methodology here. He says, so he sang, on this glorious and auspicious day of the waxing moon, this holiday of the 10th day at this feast, a son who is unswerving in his vows, that's the prince, you, prince of Lokya, have requested, sing a song never sung before. And then he says, I've traveled a long way on the road and my body is overcome with weariness. Remember, he's traveling on his first journey to India. Therefore, this song will not be melodious, nor ravishing to your mind. And I'm not even skilled in composing songs, because there is no one more important than you, my friend, and since I cannot refuse an important man, I will sing a wondrous song which has never been heard before, a song of the sayings and thoughts of the Lord Brahman. You, the many monks and practitioners who fill these seats, listen carefully and consider this in your hearts. The Lord Brahman is referring to Saraha, which is a great yogi, Indian yogi in this tradition, who I believe had passed on. I mean, I don't think he was alive at this time, but a very famous hermit yogi, Buddhist. And so he continues. He said, in the third months of last spring, I came up from the land of central Nepal, and being on the road the time of one meal, I arrived at the Nepalese custom taxation in a town of lower caste people. The custom tax collectors exploit any man they meet and detain defenseless traveling Tibetans. Things haven't changed much. I, too, had to stay several days against my will. One night, while dreaming in a light sleep, two beautiful Brahmin girls of authentic being, wearing the Brahmanical thread, smiling coyly and glancing out of the corners of their eyes, came before me and said, "You must go to Sri Parvata in the south." I said, "I've never gone there before. I don't even know the way." The two girls replied, "Brother, you don't have to do anything difficult. We shall carry you on our shoulders." So they put me on a seat of a cloth palanquin and lifted it into the sky like a parasol. Like a flash of lightning in a mere instant of time, I dreamt that I arrived at Sri Parvata in the south, in the cool shade of a grove of plaxa trees, on a Tirukorp seat, sat Lord Saraha, the great Brahmin. I had never before seen such majestic brilliance. He was flanked by two queens. His body was adorned with the charnel ground ornaments, skulls and bones. His joyous face was beaming. "Welcome, my son," he said. Seeing the Lord, I was overwhelmed with joy. The hairs of my body stood on end, and I was moved to tears. I circumambulated him seven times, and I offered full prostration. I received the soles of his feet on the top of my head. "Father, accept me with kindness," I supplicated. He blessed my body with his. The moment he touched his hand to the top of my head, my body was intoxicated with undefiled bliss. Like an elephant drunk with liquor, there dawned an experience of immovability. He blessed my speech with his. With the lion's roar of emptiness, he spoke, quote-unquote, that without letter. Like a dream dreamt by a mute, there dawned an experience beyond words. He blessed my mind with his, and I realized the co-emergent Dharmakaya, that which neither comes nor goes. Like a human corpse left in a charnel ground, there dawned an experience of non-thought. Then the pure speech of great bliss arose from the vase of his precious throat. With sign speech and the melody of Brahma, he sang this Vajra song which points out things as they are, the meaning of the empty sky free from clouds. Thus I heard this unborn self-utterance. So now he's in the dream, Sahara sings him a song. You understand? So now this is the song that Sahara sang to him. Namo. Compassion and emptiness are inseparable. This uninterrupted flowing innate mind is suchness, primordially pure. Space is seen in intercourse with space. Because the root resides at home, mind consciousness is imprisoned. Meditating on this, subsequent thoughts are not patched together, chained together in the mind. Knowing the phenomenal world is the nature of mind, meditation requires no further antidote. The nature of mind cannot be thought. Rest in this natural state, my son. When you see this truth, you will be liberated. Just as a child would, watch the behavior of barbarians. Be carefree. Eat flesh. Be a madman. Just like a fearless lion, let your elephant mind wander free. See the bees hovering among the flowers. Not viewing samsara as wrong. There is no such thing as attaining nirvana. This is the way of ordinary mind. Rest in natural freshness. Do not think of activities. Do not cling to one side or one direction. Look into the midst of space, of the space of simplicity. You don't hear songs like this on the radio, do you? This is quite a song. Quite a song within quite a song. If I commented on this, it would take the rest of the retreat. So I'll just let it rest with you for now, and we'll be coming back to these thoughts. But did you hear his advice? just as a child would watch the behavior of barbarians. Barbarians are who? Everybody in the world. They're barbarous. They run by principles that are barbarous. They don't eat one another, but they come close. They're barbarians. So they see each other as objects to exploit, right? For their own needs, personal needs, psychological needs, emotional needs. They destroy their own environment. They hoard their wealth while others are starving. They slaughter innocent men and children. Right. These are barbarians. And they are us. So he says, as a child would watch the behaviors of a barbarian. A child is what? Innocent and awestruck by this behavior. Unbelievable. Then he says, be carefree. What a wonderful instruction. Be carefree. Eat flesh. Now, those of us who are vegetarians or even those of us who stepped into the world of being vegans might be bothered by this. But understand where these guys were coming from. Don't judge them. You know, he was saying, don't be caught by conventionality. Be free. Live from the deepest understanding, wisdom. Be a madman. You know what they say when you go into a psychiatric facility? The only way you can tell the mad from the non-mad, you can only tell the mad from the keepers, is who's holding the keys. You watch them by behavior, right? Ken knows that. Right? That's the way you can tell. So this is a madman, not in the painful way that we see people who are mentally ill. He's not talking about that. He's saying, if what passes in ordinary life is normal, be a mad person. We are mad people, right? Because the world believes in violence. The world believes in an eye for tooth and tooth, right? So we're mad because we believe in nonviolence, right? Normal people believe in what? Getting as much as I can and screw your neighbor. Don't care about anybody else. So those who really care for other people, who see other people as no different than themselves, who want everybody to prosper, not just me, that's madness, isn't it, in this society? So, I mean, please understand what this teaching's about. Let your elephant mind wander free. Many of us think here, my problem is I let this elephant mind wander free, and it's endlessly just causing problems. And listen to this, he says, let it run free. Now, we'll talk over the next little days what he means. This is a wonderful teaching. This is not let it run free and to trample the the trample. It's and he uses the description, see the bees hovering among the flowers. The bee goes what? The bee goes from flower to flower, doesn't it? It doesn't only go to one flower. You watch the bees, they go from flower to flower to flower. They take from this, they take from that, they take more from this, a little from that, right? They go from, right? Just following their nature, following their instinct. They're free. They are not bound by ideas and views. They are just free to follow their instinct. Not viewing samsara as wrong, and no such thing as attained to nirvana. Again, most people are caught in this duality. Samsara, you know, this world is bad, I got to get to this place called nirvana. I mean, obviously, he's elucidating the teaching of non-duality, where both to see things as no good and to see this as good is our only projections of the mind. He's pointing to a state of mind that is non-dual, that doesn't discriminate, that doesn't judge. This is the way of the ordinary mind. There was a great Zen teacher, I forget his name, they said, "What is the Buddha mind?" he was asked. He said, "Everyday mind is Buddha mind." What is everyday mind? This very mind that is listening to me right now. This is your everyday mind, and this is no other than your Buddha mind. Why don't we know that? Because we don't know it. When you know it, you'll see that it is the way it is. And rest in the natural freshness. Don't think of activities, which means what? Stop thinking. Stop ruminating. Stop fantasizing. Stop going over. Stop thinking about life and live life. Rest in the natural freshness. Look into the midst of space of simplicity. So then he says, now we're back to Marpa. "At that moment I awoke. I was caught by the iron hook of this unforgettable memory within the dungeon of ignorant sleep." Beautiful. "The vision of insight wisdom opened up and the sun dawned in a cloudless sky, clearing the darkness of confusion. I thought even if I met the Buddhas of the three times from now on, I would have nothing to ask them." Quite a dream. Like everything had been resolved. Quite a dream. If I met the Buddha, I'm able to go, wow. If I met the Buddhas of the three times, I would have so many questions for them. How wonderful to be in the presence of the three Buddhas and I could ask them anything I wanted, right? Bill Menzel would give anything. He'd give his right arm to be in the presence of the three Buddhas. Marpa said, "If I ran into them at this point, I wouldn't have a thing to ask them." How do you like that? What a dream, what an experience. "This was the decisive experience. Discursive thoughts were exhausted." What a wonder. There was nothing to think about anymore. He knew. He said, "Even though I was told not to speak of these things," because again, in these traditions, these kinds of inner experiences are considered not to be talked about publicly. They are secret. Not secret like they're a big secret, secret that most people would not understand them, or if they heard these kinds of teachings or experience would misinterpret them. So traditionally, these most profound teachings of the nature of mind and reality were not openly talked about. So he says, "Even though I've been told not to speak of these things, tonight I can't help but speak them. Except for this occasion, I have never said this before. Listen with your ears and repeat it at a later time. This is Marpa. I am a man who has traveled a long way without intimate friends and relatives. Now when my body becomes tired and hungry, son, what you have done will be in my mind," which means he's taken care of him this past month. "I won't forget this. It's impressed deeply in my mind. My heart friend, your kindness is repaid." Then he invokes all his kind of deities. He's a tantric practitioner. He's got lots of deities. And he says, "May all these please not scold me. Please forgive me if there's any confusion in what I've said." So just to make sure, you know, that he hasn't harmed anything by disclosing these secret teachings and he hasn't caused anybody to be more confused than they already were, he begs the forgiveness of his deities. So that's, and let me last read, I'm now going to read from the introduction, and it gives a description of what Marpa might have been like when Milarepa encounters him. We're just about to get there. This is the translator of this book writing. He said, "For all his realization and mastery, it is said that Marpa lived in a hidden manner. It is true that in many ways he was very ordinary. Traditionally, he has been described as tall, stocky, with a sunburned face, crew-cut hair, and a mustache and a light beard. He was a householder, farmer, husband, father. He ate good food, drank lots of barley beer, and lost his temper with his wife and children." Sounds like a typical man, right? I mean. His approach to everything was thoroughly businesslike, practical, earthy. At his home in Lautrec, Marpas seemingly did not have much time to practice meditation. Certainly he did not spend most of his time in intensive retreat, as did Milarepa and his later disciples. Moreover, he was not even outwardly recognized as a spiritual person, since he did not wear the robes of a monk or a yogin. Even his neighbors and relatives had doubts at times about him being a spiritual teacher. However, through his ability to completely unify his practice and his realization with his ordinary life, Marpa's vision and activity were vast and precise, beyond what one would expect of an ordinary farmer or businessman. Marpa did not try to become special or a different kind of person. There are many people on their spiritual path whose own goal is to become special, to look special, to be special, to be a different kind of person. Please understand that this profound great teacher of Milarepa did not make that effort at all. He was totally himself. Marpa did not try to become a special or different person, but simply used his ordinariness as the path. And such it became the expression of his realization. That's a little about Marpa, Milarepa's teacher, the one he was sent to by that other lama who said, this guy is a tough nut. He needs somebody who knows how to handle characters like mass murderers. Hmm? I mean, just to put it bluntly, he says, this is handling a mass murderer is beyond me. Handling somebody is beyond me. He needs somebody special. So now we get to another very famous aspect of the story of Milarepa, which is the way Marpa teaches him. It's very famous, and many people are very confused by it. So Milarepa is coming along. He asks for directions to Marpa's house. He had a dream that Milarepa, his disciple, His true disciple was coming. And so he's paid attention. So he tells his wife, I'm going to go out and plow the field near the road. And she says to him, but that's the work for laborers. You're a great lama. If you do that kind of work, everyone's going to ridicule us. Please don't do it. But he paid no attention to her. Bring me plenty of beer, he said. And he picked up a full jar, adding, I will drink this beer, bring more for my guests. So he took another jar and departed. So he started plowing the field, watched the road, drank his beer, and waited. And along comes Marpa. He asked directions from people. He's going on, where's the great lama? He's heard about this great lama. Where's the great lama? And then he comes along, and he gets where he thought he is, and he sees this man. At the side of the road, there was a tall and corpulent, here he calls him a monk, so maybe at that point he was dressed in robes, some kind of robe. So a tall and corpulent monk with large eyes and an awesome look was plowing a field. And at that moment, he was filled with joy and bliss. And so obviously there is this deep karmic connection, and the two of them. He asks this guy, he says, Master, I've heard that the learned Marpa the translator, personal disciple of the glorious Naropa, dwells in this region. Where is his house? And then Marpa looks him up and down and says, who are you? He says, I'm a great sinner, and I've come from Tsang. Marpa is so renowned, I've come to beg him for his teaching. And so he says, okay, I'll go arrange a meeting with him, but you plow this field, He gave him a jar of beer, and which Miller found very refreshing, and he went to work on the field. Sometime later, somebody comes up, the Lama will see you, but Miller says he wants to finish the field first. So then he went up to the house afterwards. The same monk who I had met a short time before was seated on a pillow at the back of two square cushions that was covered with a rug. He had wiped his face with his eyebrows, his nostrils, his mustache, and his beard was still covered with dust, and he was eating his meal. I thought, this is the same one as before. Where can the Lama be? The Lama said to him, it's true you do not know me. I am Marpa. Prostrate yourself. So I bowed at his feet and I said, Lama Rinpoche, which means precious teacher, I am the great sinner. I offer you my body, speech, and mind. I ask for food, clothing, teaching. Teach me the way which leads to enlightenment in this lifetime. How heartfelt, right? Marpa goes, I don't want to hear your ravings about being a great sinner. I didn't make you commit sins. You know, anyhow. Right. And so Marpa, so then Milarepa tells him all the sins he's done. All right. And then Marpa goes, all right, so you've done all that. Anyhow, it's good that you're here and you're offering me your body, speech, and mind. But then he says something very interesting. He says, but I am not, see, it's interesting. In those days, and still almost to today, oftentimes when a teacher accepts a student, they take care of them. You know, we think it should be the opposite, but often they take care of them. Because often the students don't have anything, and he's come to Marpa's home. So Marpa said, look, you want the teachings, but you also want, if you're going to live here with me, to, you know, food and clothing. I'm not going to give you both, right? I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the food and clothing, and you go to some other lama and get the teaching, all right? But if you choose the teaching, then whether or not you achieve enlightenment in this life will depend solely on your own striving. And Milarepa says, since I came to you for the teaching, I will look elsewhere for food and clothing. And then I went, and then Milarepa goes to, he's got this sacred book of all his exorcisms, you know, all this sacred book that he's been, his holy book. And he goes to put it up on the altar, and the Milarepa says, take that filth away. Defile my sacred objects and my shrine. So anyway, this was the first meeting of Marpa and Milarepa. So then he goes into the village, and he begs barley and meal and beer and meat and all this stuff in a cooking pot, and he brings it all back to offer to the Lama. The Lama's eating his meal. Marpa comes in. He makes a rude comment to him. He said, you're obnoxious. And he takes Milarepa's offerings and he kicks it away. And I thought to myself, wow, this Lama is irritable. I'll have to watch my behavior and my way of serving. But then something interesting happened. I mean, it's interesting about this. You'll see how Marpa is one way with him and yet in another way encourages him. So then after all these offerings that he'd spent days collecting and carrying on his back, Marpa just kicks it away. Remember, on top of all the offerings, he'd collected an empty pot, like something to cook in. And I returned with the empty pot. He took it in his hands and he held it for a moment, his eyes pensive. Tears fell from his eyes, and he said, your gift is auspicious. I offer it to the great master, Naropa, which was his teacher. The empty pot. And he offered. Again at this moment, I was overcome with emotion and was burning with desire for Dharma. I begged him to instruct. So first the Lama has him. He says, there are these villagers who are harassing my disciples when they come. I mean, again, you can remember, Tibet is a little much of a wild, woolly place, sort of like the Old West, and there were bandits. I mean, there was a lot. So I guess when his disciples would come see him, they had to go through this valley, and they'd always be harassed by these people. So he says, would you please go cast some of your spells and send some hailstones down on these people? You know, again, Milarepa is coming to get away from his old life, right? Sort of like coming to your teacher, and you've, you know, been a thief your whole life, and your teacher says, fine, I will teach you, but first, you know, I need some of this. Would you go rob this person and that person? So he, anyhow, it's an interesting story. But finally he does, and so then he comes back, and he asks for the teacher, and the Lama says to him, all right, yesterday I was very hard on you. Don't be distressed. Patient. Teaching is very slow work, but you are a highly energetic guy. I want you to build a tower for my son. And when you do that, I will give you the Dharma and food and clothing. But Milarepa says, but during all this time that I'm doing this work, if I die without the Dharma, what will become of me? And Marpa says, I guarantee you will not die during this time. My teaching can be expressed in a few words. My teaching can be expressed in a few words. If you can meditate with perseverance according to my instructions, you will show whether you can or cannot attain enlightenment in this lifetime. With these comforting words, I was filled to joy. Next begins a very famous unfolding. Milarepa, Marpa, and the Towers. And this is very famous and very an interesting way of looking at the teacher-student relationship. So Milarepa begins to build a tower. When I've half finished, the Lama came to him and said, the other day I had not fully considered the matter. Tear down this tower, take the earthen stones back to their original places. And after he'd done that, he says, the Lama comes to him, he pretends to be drunk and says, I want a tower like the one over there. I want you to, you know, points to a neighbor's, I want you to build that here. So now he once again, Milarepa is building a tower. And then a few days later, Marpa comes and says, the other day I was drunk and I didn't give you good directions. But instead I want a tower built over there. And Milarepa goes, to tear something down while it's being built makes me miserable and it's a waste of your wealth. Please think carefully beforehand next time. And Marpa goes, today I am not drunk. I have thought about it very carefully. And he tells him, and it will not be torn down. Of course, you know what happens. He gets the tower almost always done. And then he comes up to him one day and says, what are you doing? Who gave you these instructions? But it was you yourself who ordered this tower. He says, I don't remember having given you such orders. If you were right, I must be crazy. Have I completely lost my mind? And Milarepa says, I clearly remember thinking that you were going to pull something like that, and I asked you to think about it carefully, and you replied that it was fully thought out and that this tower would never be demolished. Marpa says, very well then, who's your witness? Sort of like, you know, sort of like, do you have it in writing? you know, anyhow, he goes on and on and on. I mean, this goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And then, but meanwhile, Marpa's wife, who's a very sweet woman, is seeing her interaction. And again, you know, Milarepa, I think, is in his late teens, early 20s, you know, and he's very sweet and he's very dedicated, you know. So she's very upset with her husband and very much taking the side of Milarepa. So, of course, several days later, Marpa shows up again, takes him for a walk, and wants him to build another tower. Then Milarepa says, he asks, wouldn't it be good that your wife be a witness to all these promises? You know? because, you know, he knows somebody's on his side. So he says, very well. And then he goes through that, and the wife is very happy to be a witness. But she said, I'm happy to be a witness, but it'll be very difficult to have my testimony upheld since Marpa, the Lama, is very autocratic. He builds without reason, he destroys without reason. Anyhow, he goes on and on. So anyhow, it goes on and on, and going back and forth and taking stones out and putting, you know, he takes out a big cornerstone, puts it at the bottom, builds this tower, and all of a sudden Marpa comes up and goes, Where'd you get that? You know, the stone at the bottom. That's the wrong stone. You know, put it back where you found it. But of course, he's got to take apart the whole tower again. Anyhow, it goes on and on and on and on and on. And then, it continues. And then, meanwhile, people are showing up to get teachings from him. And so Milarepa is saying, won't you let me in? And so Marpa is giving this teaching to all these other disciples. Milarepa comes in because he feels like, wow, I've been working so hard, right? Wouldn't you think so? I mean, look what I've been through for this guy, all for the Dharma. Now he's giving a teaching, at least like he'll let me listen in. So he goes in, and Marpa says to him, what gift have you given me? Traditionally, in Tibet today, when you're requesting a teaching from a teacher, you offer them a gift. So what did you bring me? And I said, I rendered you homage by building the tower for you. You promised to give me instruction. That's why I'm here. And Marpa says, you made a little tower which isn't even as thick as my arm. It's hardly worth the Dharma which I, with great difficulty, brought all the way from India. If you have the price of my teaching, give it to me. Otherwise, do not stay here among the initiates of this secret teaching. Speaking thus, he slapped me, grabbed me by the hair, and threw me out. I wanted to die. I wept the whole night. The Lama's wife came to console. And Milarepa is going, the Lama's always said the teachings were brought back to him from India for the good of all sentient beings. Were even a dog to present himself to him, he would teach it the Dharma. Why does he refuse me? Oh, no, this is the wife saying, I can't figure out why he refuses you. I mean, he would teach a dog. I do not know. In any fate, do not have bad thoughts. Anyhow, so this continues on and on. I mean, one tower after the other. At a certain point, Milarepa has so many sores on his back from carrying these stones. Pus and blood were running from his wounds. Everybody's just beside themselves with his suffering. And the Lama continues. And then the Lama relents a little bit and gives him padding to put on his back, you know, the kind of padding that they put on horses and donkeys, you know, when the donkeys are carrying load. So Lama, in his great compassion, gives Milarepa one of those donkey pads to pull on this one. I mean, he goes on. Again, another time, Milarepa said, I'm going to leave. I can't take it anymore. And the Lama comes out and slaps him. When you arrived here, you at once gave me, you offered me your body, speech, and mind. Where are you going now? Surely you're not leaving. You belong to me. And I could cut you body, speech, and mind into 100 pieces. And he saw, because actually Milarepa had been given some flour by Marpa's wife. And he says, in spite of you going away, you're taking my flour. And he started slapping me again. And he's just weeping, weeping, weeping. And Milarepa thought about going to another lama. And so in cahoots with Marpa's wife, he goes off to one of Marpa's disciples, and she forges a letter in Marpa's handwriting saying, you know, this is a good disciple of Marpa. If Marpa doesn't have any time to teach him, will you teach him? Okay, and so he does. He does teach him. He gives him some teaching. But again, he really doesn't have any meditative experience. So then there's some festival or something going on in Marpa's house, and the Lama comes. He comes with Milarepa, Marpa just beats the hell out of him. And how dare you go and misrepresent yourself to my own disciple? It gets to the point where he's finally suicidal. He's about to kill himself, and that monk who had been teaching him, Marpa's disciple, said, "Worthy Milarepa, don't do that. According to the most secret teachings of the Buddha, the faculties and the senses of each of us are innately divine. If you die before your time, you commit the sin of killing a god, a Buddha. This is why suicide is such a great time. Even in the exoteric tradition of the sutras, there's no greater sin than to cut off one's own life. Please give up the idea of killing yourself. It is still possible that the Lama will give you the teaching. But if he doesn't, another Lama surely will." While he was speaking in this way, some of the other monks, not able to bear my misfortune, went up to the Lama to see if the moment had come to intercede for me. Others came to comfort me. In spite of that, filled with anguish, I thought, "Is my heart made of iron? For if it were not, it would have burst, and I would be dead. It is because of the crimes that I committed in my youth that I endured such suffering while seeking the Dharma." At that moment, of all the group, there was none who was not sobbing tearfully. Some of them were so overcome with grief, they fainted. And finally, guess what? Marpa teaches him. He said, "Tonight it will not be as before." He calls Milarepa the great magician, sort of tongue in cheek. "Oh, great magician," he calls him. He said, "Tonight the great magician is to be our principal guest." And he says to his wife, "Go and fetch him." And she comes to Milarepa and says, "The Lama now appears to be taking you as a disciple. He seems deeply moved by compassion. He said you were to be the principal guest and has sent me to fetch you. He hasn't said any harsh words to me. Let us rejoice and go." I wondered if it was true, and wrongly filled with apprehension, I went in. Then the Lama spoke. This is Marpa. He says, "If everything is carefully examined, not one of us is to be blamed. I have merely tested the great magician to purify him of his wrongdoing. If the work in the tower had been intended for my gain, I would have been gentle in the giving of orders. Therefore, I was sincere. Being a woman, the mistress was also right not to be able to bear the situation. Yet her excessive compassion in deceiving with the sacred objects and the forged letters was a serious indulgence." And then he says to Nopa, his disciple who taught him, "You were right in the matter you related." Because the wife had stolen some things from her husband to give to the guy to teach him under false pretenses, anyhow. But I won't punish you for that. Then he says something very interesting. He said, "Although my anger rose like a floodwater, it is not like worldly anger. However they may appear, my actions always come from religious considerations, which in essence conform to the path of enlightenment. As for the rest of you who are not yet immersed in Dharma, Do not let your faith be shaken. Had this son of mine, he's referring to Milarepa, completed the 9 great ordeals, had completed the last tower, his complete enlightenment without future rebirth would have been achieved without leaving any bodily residue. But since due to my wife's weakness that didn't take place, there will now continue to remain a faint stain of defilement with him. However, his great sins have been eased by his afflictions and his agonies that he has gone through with me. Now I receive you and will give you my teaching, which is as dear to me as my own heart. I will help you with provisions and let you meditate and be happy. As he was saying these words, Milarepa wondered, is this a dream? Or am I awake? If it is a dream, I wish never to awaken. At this thought, my happiness was boundless. Shedding tears of joy, I prostrated myself. Many people thought at the time what skillful means and power Marpa has when he wants to accept a disciple. He himself is a living Buddha. And their faith grew more and more, and out of their love for me, they all cheerfully prostrated themselves before the Lama. And then he goes on to give him teaching. Tells him kind of the meaning of the whole process. And he says, each time I cruelly drove you out from the ranks of disciples and you were overwhelmed with grief, you never had any bad thoughts against me. And thus, this was the beginning of my happiness. So this takes us up to the beginning of Milarepa's life as a practitioner and then as a teacher. We will be dealing with this over the next 3 days. I think you will enjoy them greatly. They are both very profound, very amusing. Because his songs involve teachings that he gave to all kinds of people, right? To his yogi disciples, to traditional monks and nuns in monasteries, to hunters, to villagers, to nobility, to young girls, to young boys. I mean, it's a whole wonderful unfolding of teaching. And he's always very skillful and appropriate and very understandable, but always pure. Any questions? Before we end, yes, Alex.
Since this was the 11th century, do you think that Marpa read the story of Job?
Mm-mm. It might have been vice versa, I don't know. But is it the same story? I mean, Job was, it's a little different, isn't it? Yeah, a little different. But it's interesting. In the sense, this is not God. In Buddhism, there's no God. But this is an enlightened teacher. And many people are very much disturbed by this, right? As you know, this is, Marpa is definitely not your traditional Dharma teacher, right? And his methods are quite extreme, aren't they? His whole presentation is highly unusual from what we expect. Even his own family and neighbors often, when they see what a deeply respected teacher he was, and people came from all over, all over Tibet to get teachings, they'd go, from him? that beer guzzling, always yelling at the wife and kids, Dharma teachings from him. These are wonderful teachings because they shake up. We see where we're attached. We see where we're attached to how things should be, how a Dharma teacher should look, or how the course of study under a Dharma teacher should proceed. When you see this undertaking that Marpa gave to Milarepa, there's always a caveat when it is transmitted, which, of course, the key piece here is that Marpa not only is his facility of enlightenment, of awakening, of the nature of reality manifested in everything he does, but he's also a man who has great insight. Right? He has great insight. He understands clearly the mind, the history of Milarepa, and he knows the exact appropriate remedy. So what it appears to us as cruel, right? Cruel. But basically, he was putting him through a process of purification very quickly. I mean, to sustain himself, if you put your hands or put yourself on the side of Milarepa, to sustain yourself in that experience, you would have to let go of everything, right? You would have to let go of everything. All your conceptions, all your ideas, all your sense of self, right, would all be eaten up, not only in the physical extreme of what he was dealing with, right? Because he drove his body to exhaustion. He drove his body to great physical pain and suffering. So not only all his attachments to his body, but all his attachment to his mind, his thoughts, his identity, everything he wanted, the Dharma and how it should be, and what he need. I mean, everything was sacrificed to what? Fulfilling his teacher's instructions. And at the end, what? At the end, Marpa said, because of your capacity to do everything I told you, with one little minor blemish, in a very short time, all that karma, all that negativity, all that you had accumulated by living for years with a mind only consumed by anger and resentment, and having done so much horrible deeds, and done so much violence, and caused so much suffering, this has all been expiated. And now everything will go smoothly. And if you think about our own minds, we realize many of us, enter the Dharma, and yet, and we practice, and yet for year after year, still we are haunted by our past. Still we are living within the stories and the histories and the conditions and the issues of our past, right? In the hands of this skillful, powerful teacher, Marpa, he wiped it out. Very powerful. So please, this is a story, a life story, but this is a very profound teaching here. So please reflect deeply on it. Any other questions before we end? Yes.
He still had to pay a price.
Who had to pay a price? What was his price?
The physical price that he paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. That was the way it was. That's the way it was expiated, because our karma is in our mind and body. Right? I mean, many of us pay a karma already, right? We pay a karma in our body for our ancestors. Many of us have diseases, physical infirmities that we inherit from our ancestors. We pay a karma for growing up in certain conditions, which expose us to certain types of diseases. And many of us have done things to our body where we, through the use of misuse of our body, toxins, etc., harm we've done to our body, we often pay the price in our bodies. You know, it reminds me of, in the time of the Buddha, there was Argunamala. You know Argunamala? He was the mass murderer. Do you remember him? With the fingers? Yeah, it's a great story from the time of the Buddha, but he was somebody who lived at the time. And he, interestingly enough, he also was a student of some sort of black magician who had said, go around collecting fingers. And when you've collected like a certain amount of fingers, I don't know, 20 fingers, 30 fingers, then I will give you teaching, or you will achieve some kind of esoteric understanding. And so he was quite feared. I mean, he was a murderer. And he had this necklace of fingers. He cut off a finger off of everybody that he killed. And he had this wonderful encounter with the Buddha, where he encountered the Buddha on the road and was going to kill him. But the Buddha, through his capacity, like Marpa, was able to take somebody of such negativity and transform him. And so Argunamala became a disciple of the Buddha. But interestingly enough, as I remember, when he, in those days, all the disciples of Buddha went from town to town begging their food. And so Argunamala would come to towns in which he had murdered people. And so when, even though he was now a monk, and had changed, shaved his head and totally renounced his past, when the villagers would see him, he would often get beaten. Like really beaten. And the Buddha said to him, it's okay. You are expiating your karma. It's okay. There's a price to be paid for what you did, and to be the recipient of these people's anger, if you can bear it, and bear them no ill will. And sort of like Milarepa. I mean, he never bore ill will toward Marpa. He always saw that this is unfolding because of me. Now again, for those of you who don't like victimization, you can go, this is not healthy, but this is not like that. This is not like that. It's much profounder than that kind of psychological blame. Because this is somebody who did horrible things. This is somebody who did do great harm. And after spending years doing harm, when harm comes to him, rather than, why me? He goes, I'm just experiencing what I gave to others, even more so. I gave to others. So let me bear this with equanimity. It's a way of, in Buddhism, of dealing with difficult situations in life that often come our way without complaining, without whining, without, just accepting at a deep level the unfolding of one's life and not let it disturb one's equanimity. And even more, it increases our desire for liberation and to be free. So anyhow, we should stop. It's kind of gotten away from me.